Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
Hey, everybody, this is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of Ad Exchanger and your host. And, well, you're in for a treat with this episode. We have Michael Barrett in the studio. Michael, welcome.
Zach, thank you for having me. Good to be here.
It's really great to have you. We've been trying to make this one happen for a while. I'm thrilled to be looking at you. So for the audience, Michael, as you probably know, is kind of a media and ad tech all-star. Ran AdMelt, sold it to Google. Global CRO at Yahoo. CEO of Millennial, sold it to AOL. Also has stints at Disney, had stints at Fox Interactive Media, MySpace. Now, he's CEO of Rubicon, and he's going to sell it to?
I'm going to sell it to our current investors. As a public company, we are always in sell mode.
Okay, there you go. Great. Well, lots to talk about with your career and with Rubicon, we will. But I also want to set the stage a little bit for that conversation because, you know, Rubicon is a company with multiple issues, including what some have described as a lack of vision on product the last couple of years. Customers feeling the company is taking too much in the way of fees. And lastly, structural changes in the market that are making it harder for SSPs and exchanges as a whole to make money and compete. The company, because of these factors, has really taken a beating with customers and with investors, pretty much been tarred and feathered and ridden around on a rail.
It's been that bad, huh?
Well,
should have talked to you before I came.
But you didn't, did you? So let's start with a softball question, which might surprise you in light of all of what I just said. But walk us through your decision process. What, you know, after so many victory laps in this industry, what drew you to run another company? What drew you to this company in particular?
Yeah, so all great questions. I mean, I think, you know, the biggest...
And we're going to get to all those other things.
Yes.
So don't try to address those in your initial response.
I'm going to nail them all right now.
We'll be done too fast.
Yes.
We're going to fill a half an hour here.
There you go. I really, really enjoy the industry, and I enjoy working with the team. And so the idea of going back to work was always there. The neat part about, if you've been in this industry long enough, you get to meet a lot of folks, and investment opportunities happen because people are just entrepreneurs by nature. And so that is that filled a lot of my time in the past year and a half. But there was always a desire to go back and look for the right opportunity. And when I left Millennial, I said, I know what I'm not ever going to do again, and that is be CEO of a public ad tech company. And so that brings us to Rubicon. And the funny thing is that I've known Rubicon for since its inception. Obviously, being at AdMeld, we were competitors and always respected Frank and the team as thought leaders, savvy marketers. Remember the days of Mad Cash and the big booths, and they had a great UI. We always kind of wished at AdMel we had a better user interface. We thought we could compete on the tools underneath it, but they were very, I think, smart and measured. And I got to see firsthand the first time they kind of got knocked on their heels when RTB came along, and they were incredibly patient about it to the point of eschewing it, and it obviously didn't work out so well. So you would think a normal company with a misstep like that, venture-backed, early stage, that's a death knell. Mm-hmm. And yet, you fast forward 24 months later, they're created separation, they're a leader in what they do, still perceived as a thought leader, never really panicked, stuck to their knitting, which was clean, well-lit, curated exchange with great tools on the edges. And that DNA, that kind of culture is just not normal for most early stage companies. And so this time around, when I was talking with Frank about some of the challenges they were facing with industry, you know, upheaval from a header in particular in their kind of reluctance to participate out of the gates and then trying to play catch up,
mm-hmm.
I kind of saw pattern recognition. I was like, this is the same organization that fought back, that became a leader, and you know, I think it has muscle memory. And I think if I were to be able to inject some fresh thinking, some energy, some enthusiasm, they'd also just hired, you know, a terrific CTO in Tom Kershaw, who came over from Google.
Mm-hmm.
So I viewed it as daunting, but the good and the bad of this industry is your clients generally don't fire you. They just stop using you, but the connections are still there. So if for whatever reason you can help them change their point of view of you, or you can come out with different tools or different products, I think the point to getting back to where you were, even in a radically changed landscape, isn't impossible. As a matter of fact, I think Rubicon's done it on several different occasions. And so I'm a heck of a lot more bullish about the prospects than most people who's come up to me. But I will also say this, and it touches a little upon about the customer feedback. Spent a ton of time with clients in the last 4 weeks. Was able to sit down with them in London, New York, mm-hmm. all the normal places. And they've all been pretty consistent. And that is, guys, you messed up. But we're still rooting for you. And
all of them think you messed up?
I think generally speaking, the consensus is one way or the other, we took our eye off the ball.
Okay.
Whether it was in super serving them,
mm-hmm.
Whether it was in answering their needs for a product roadmap that matched what they wanted. I think a lot of it had to do with header. I think a lot of it was we asked you, we begged you to do this, and you didn't. And
okay.
It bums us out that you didn't, because you were our number one guy. And
mm-hmm.
And they fought long and hard to get to that spot, as they kind of gave you the brief 10-year history, which is this month is the 10-year anniversary of Rubicon.
Okay.
It is. So happy birthday.
Well, happy birthday.
To us.
Yeah.
You. Yeah. They fought tooth and nail to earn that. No one gave them anything, right? You know, mm-hmm. So even if the world's changed and it's not a waterfall world and we're off to the next thing, and I'm sure we'll talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Rubicon somehow or another was able to separate from the pack for a number of reasons, I feel. And so there is an affection, an affinity, a close bond between Rubicon and the customers. And it's my job and it's the team's job to rebuild that trust, but to also do it in action and not just words. And I think we're well on our way to doing that. And
okay.
We got some exciting stuff coming up down the pipe.
Okay. Well, the ultimate proof for them will be yield. Header bidding has taken a lot of has been great for publishers because it improves their yield. But partly by creating more competition in the auction and then taking margin out of the middle layer, which was Rubicon and other SSPs as well as DSPs. So talk about the header bidding thing. It's crushed margins for companies like Rubicon, been great for your customers who are aware of it and embracing it. What are you going to do? What's the right response for Rubicon in the context of the header bidding phenomenon?
Yeah, well, I think as acknowledged, a bit late to the game,
right.
Allowed other folks to take leadership positions, whether mm-hmm. it was through actions or thought. But it's funny, it wasn't because Rubicon was oblivious. Obviously, the world is moving towards a mobile first world if it's not already there. And a subset of that mobile would be, you know, video and orders. And most companies have limited resources. We're no different than that. And if a new technology comes along that's primarily North American desktop, you're kind of faced with a decision on allocation of resources, right? And mm-hmm. I think the miss was that it fundamentally changed how monetization was going to be perceived going forward. So
yeah.
Publishers and buyers have both voted that a unified auction, whether it occurs on the client side or the server side, but that unified auction is the way to go forward. Mm-hmm. And I think what happens when you miss out in the early stages of it, you miss out on the learnings of it initially, and you miss out on your marketplace position. Mm-hmm. But the good news is, as dynamic as the industry is, every new wave of changes that are coming, maybe server to server, you have a whole nother opportunity to regain trust, regain pole position, come out with products that are made for that new world. And I think we're well on our way there, and feel really confident that we are listening closely with our clients about what their needs are, mm-hmm. about the shortcomings of the current situation of header, the impact it's having on loads, the impact it's having on transparency, perhaps. And I think that going forward, you know, we've listened really hard and we'll participate in the way they'd like us to participate going forward.
Okay, great. In terms of other product priorities, do you want to run through them? I mean, the header thing and making sure that you're providing maybe a server-to-server solution as that becomes more kind of the standard. But are there other areas where you're putting the pedal down that you'd like to touch on?
Yeah, I mean, you've run the risk, obviously, in a pretty competitive world of spilling the beans too early. But that said, as I did mention before, it's the 10th year anniversary, and that always brings with it some reflection. And I was talking with Frank the other day and said, if you were to build Rubicon in 2017, what would it look like? Because it sure as heck wouldn't be the thing built in 2007. Mm-hmm. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but the world changes 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And so I think approaching it from that approach is the right way to go. Mm-hmm. Because if you approach it with, oh, we just have to slap on a new thing here, a new thing there, and meet the current needs, you're kind of mired into what an SSP that evolved to an independent ad exchange, what you know, that becomes the sole value proposition. And maybe that isn't the value proposition going forward.
What about Salesforce enablement? Does that rank high in your...
I think if you look at the... so as a company, we dabbled a couple of years ago and mm-hmm. bought a demand source.
Right.
The logic there was sound.
Chango?
Correct.
Okay.
Then changed the name to Intent Marketing when it was part of Rubicon. And the logic was sound because we actually pursued the strategy at Millennial, and that is bring proprietary demand to what is otherwise a pretty indistinguishable exchange. So what's your mm-hmm. value proposition to supply other than all the nuanced stuff? Bring proprietary demand, and then mm-hmm. the only way you can get this demand if you plug in. And I think there's validity to that thinking. It's just you have to bring so much proprietary demand to matter in a world of 600 billion transactions a day on our exchange, right? I mean, if Google can't do it with their demand, mm-hmm. It's really hard to think that. So I think we learned a lesson there and said – let's stay on the edges. Obviously, thankfully, we never thought of creating content and becoming a publisher. Mm-hmm. So let's just stay and run this clean, well-lit, curated exchange that's fair, that's transparent, that's reasonably priced. And then look what we can do on the edges of that. What can we do to help buyers in this world where they're choking on inventory? What can we do to help sellers, you know, maximize optimization and do several other things that are important to them? And I think it starts to stretch the definition of what the exchange, the SSP might be.
Okay.
But I think it's timely because things are changing and you have to adapt with it.
Okay, great. Well, that actually tees up the next sort of group of questions nicely, which is you mentioned transparency and fair pricing as two areas of opportunity for Rubicon this year. So Rubicon and other SSPs, but Rubicon especially, I would say, has gotten tripped up on fees. One is this lawsuit with The Guardian, that The Guardian filed. And I realize you may not be able to speak in this context to the lawsuit, but their complaint has to do with fees that Rubicon had charged to the buy side that the publisher customer wasn't aware of. So that transparency issue. Could you speak to this buy side fees issue? Like, there's the past. What's the future?
Sure. So you have to be careful here because obviously it's an ongoing litigation. But that said, it's never the high water mark of any company to be sued by a valued partner. Again, parking lotting the validity of the legal action. Let's talk about transparency. One of the ironic aspects is that no one's been more transparent than Rubicon, and that's part of the position we find ourselves in is because as a public
because you're public
company,
and that stuff's all
company you listed.
Stuff's all in your
right
documents.
Exactly, and I don't think you hear too many sellers, publishers, mobile apps complaining about lack of awareness of the fees that we charge them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you did hit the nail on the head when you talked about buy-side fees.
Mm-hmm.
And without going into specifics about how we break it out, I think there's inherent fairness to that. I always thought it was a little strange that, say, the gold standard Google would just charge publishers and not charge buyers. It makes a lot of sense if you're the largest buyer on the internet. That's probably a silly precedent to start.
Okay.
But let's just say that if somehow or another you can fairly distribute the expense of running this massive technology investment that we have and distribute it equally, partially equally, close to equally among buyers and sellers.
Okay.
And have that number, that combined take rate, if you will, fall right smack in the sweet spot.
What's the
of
sweet
the
spot?
Industry. I think what we have said publicly is that as marketplaces mature, especially internet-backed marketplaces, that you can anticipate total take rates in the 15 to 20% range for a marketplace.
Okay. So if it was 18, split the difference. You're saying equal distribution of fees to the buy and sell side, so 9% each way or something like that?
Philosophically, yeah.
Okay.
That makes a ton of sense, right,
okay.
to me.
So it would be flat, and then everybody would know how much it was.
Exactly. Everyone would know.
That's not the state of play today, but that's where you're heading.
It will be very shortly.
Okay.
Yeah, and so that's our complete intent. Obviously, you got to be a little careful here. The more you grind to specifics, you get into contractual information. It's like, hey, whoa, you're showing the rate I negotiated with you. So it has to be somehow like if it's not 1,000 feet, but it's not ground level, let's say call it 100 feet. But to your point, what you just described is exactly what we're going to do.
Okay.
Exactly what we're going to do.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, thanks for answering that question in that much detail. I didn't quite expect that. I guess a question on maybe philosophical question on the buy side and how they may react to this. Because in principle, I understand the desire to, if you spread the fees, if you spread your margin out so that the seller doesn't pay the whole thing, it makes you a better partner to them. From the buy side's point of view, I'm wondering if it's going to be something they're comfortable with. If they feel like, okay, well, I might be able to get this supply somewhere else if I'm getting this money tacked on to my bid or whatever. So could you speak to that? Do you think the buy side will accept the fact that these fees exist in the marketplace?
Well, they've had for 10 years. And so whether or not there's been heightened awareness like we're witnessing today, but boy, when you walk
– maybe I'll phrase that differently.
Yeah.
I think you're right. Let me phrase it a little differently. The nature of the auction is changing such that whoever charges the least fees wins the auction often. So if you try to hold the line on this 9%, what if PubMatic does not hold the line? Or, you know, and you end up with a situation where it's hard to compete in the auction and still retain that margin. Do you think that long term there will be things will stabilize where the exchange or SSP partners are able to justify to both sides of the marketplace their margin?
Without a doubt. And again, keep in mind it's just a mechanic. If you fall in a 15 to 20% range and charge one side or the other, it's still it's amazing how on the margins the elasticity doesn't exactly behave directly proportionate to who's getting charged what. And I do think if you just stop there and you said, okay, halt all development, halt all innovation, and it's the exact same product that you're offering today in a future state world where it's server to server and it's all humming, I would say that that would be a foolish move on anyone's part to think they can maintain the economics that they enjoyed previously. So with continued investment, with continued new products, with continued enhanced services, I don't necessarily agree with you that the cheapest place is the best place. For instance, look at all the brand safety issues that have arisen recently, especially as it relates to open auction. So open auction, if it continually is of debate, the quality of what you're buying, even if it's the cheapest, you're going to lose that client as a DSP. So that's number – that's the first issue. Second issue is the world is shifting from open auction to more PMP orders-based business rapidly, in large part because safety, brand safety, brand security, transparency, et cetera. So that's a big and growing piece of our business. That isn't anywhere near priced as open auction. And keep in mind all the pricing we've been talking about is open auction. So if you build better pipes, if you build better connections, better dashboards, et cetera, to operate these private marketplaces, they're only going to increase in popularity. You know, the push towards automation is inescapable, right? And that's exactly the byproduct of that, the byproduct of automation and byproduct of brand safety. So there's just going to be new products that come along. It's not just all open auction.
But what do you think is the end state for the open auction? Do we get to a point where it's basically is a tiny pool of supply or non-existent and everything is private? Or where do we net out with the open?
I think if you were to take the, you know, Comscore top 500 sites, apps, and take them out of the equation, open auction is about the only way to monetize below that. And if you kind of believe in a free, independent, open, creatively exploding internet mobile ecosystem, it's hard to for me to believe that that just gets mothballed and that the open auction doesn't play a role. I mean, that that is the lifeblood of monetization for the vast majority of publishers. The private marketplace stuff we're talking about is kind of the rich man's problem, the really well-established content guys. That is not, you know, 100% of the monetization of the web or the mobile ecosystem by any stretch. And so I think that it still plays a vitally important role in the ecosystem. It'll just probably shift from where it was really important for some people. It's not as important anymore, but it will be the main access point to monetization for the vast majority of content creators.
Fast forward 2-3 years, how does the mid-tail of publishers look? And I think of that as maybe Rubicon's addressable opportunity. Obviously, there's a lot of publishers that now have a Facebook instant articles strategy or a Facebook-only strategy, and there's a lot of publishers publishing on Google AMP. There's, you know, the world of, I mean, Snapchat, Apple News, and those are all places where an independent operator doesn't really, you know, do business. So where Rubicon does business is in O&O. So what's the future of O&O, do you think? And do you see that as a growing opportunity or is it static? Does that make sense, that question?
No, yeah, it's a great question. And and then you got to even extend it to being global in nature, right?
Right.
You know, I think in the face of the publishers changing, right, that I've learned my lesson very well at Millennial, you know, company at 65,000 distributed SDKs, and its pitch was premium publishers. Mm. And I looked at the top 10, and they weren't sketchy by any stretch, but, you know, a flashlight app. but the whole definition of what a premium publisher or a mid-tail publisher in a mobile app world, which is predominantly entertainment and games and functionality and productivity, changes. So I think that, yes, your observations, I think, are accurate as it relates to what we think of the digital publishing ecosystem on the web and mobile web. But the surge of spend and traffic coming from the mobile app world is entirely different and not a distributed world, not distributed on the platforms. It's still very much app-centered, and I'm sure there'll be deep linking and all sorts of things that it'll start to behave and be more targetable, et cetera. But there's no question that that's where this is all heading. And I think the opportunity there and the size of the publishers and the size of the inventory probably dwarfs what we just saw for the last 5 years.
Out of home, radio, traditional channels, Rubicon opportunity there? I know you guys have done a bunch already.
Yeah. So basically, you know, partners like Spotify, Pandora, our out-of-home partners, connected TV partners, digital jukebox, you name it. If it's API.
I'm curious, non-mobile or desktop revenues, what percentage of Rubicon's business today? Like things that are not standard digital advertising.
Oh, yeah, boy, it would be.
Tiny still.
Yeah, in the scheme of things,
sub 5% still?
It's a company that'll do over $1 billion in spend will course through the system.
Okay,
so
yeah.
It's even if it were material, it would be smaller. But no, it's very exciting, the areas of all things audio, right?
Yeah.
Back to the future. It's super exciting, and then the whole OTT opportunity, I think, is a large one for us, particularly given the nature of the folks that we've worked with historically, and the investments that we've made in our product roadmap there, and the continued investments we're going to make. And we were talking before we went on air, the idea that there's, you know, going to be 10, maybe 11, 12. Major skinny bundles out there,
right,
with a smattering of different video folks. The technology challenge and opportunity for a company like us, which is inherently, we're just a plumbing company. We build connections, we build, open up APIs, and we connect people and let it flow. Historically, we've sourced the demand. Going forward, though, you know, certainly in the private marketplace business, more often than not, we're not sourcing the demand. And so I just think you have to be pretty facile as you go forward and just keep in mind what we truly do well, and that is we're a great integrator and we're great at building technology that connects people.
Okay, great. So would your job – I mean, undoubtedly, your job would be easier if Rubicon weren't public. You could be a little more secretive about product plans and move a little faster maybe. Is there a chance that that will happen, that Rubicon will go private and you will be able to run this company with a little bit more of a cloak?
Yeah. I guess the simple thing is be careful what you wish for. Being public is just that. It's very public. And every 90 days you're putting forth your report card.
Right.
And there's a considerable amount of resources and energy at any public company not focused on the core business. It's focused on, hey, you got to get ready for earnings.
How much of your time is dealing with investors? I'm curious.
To be quite frank, at the expense of angering perhaps some of my shareholders, very little right now.
Okay.
There's a time and a place for that, and I think we can meet with all the investors in the world and have the greatest story and show the greatest decks and wow them with our insights. And they probably walk away with the idea of put up or shut up. And that's our opportunity now, is to put up. Our opportunity is to run a great company, bring it back to where it was, accelerate revenue growth, you know, super serve our clients. And that's not stuff you spend doing, you know, meeting with investors. Obviously, there's a portion of your time that has to be devoted to that. But going back to the benefits about being public, it's pretty easy to pick the ugly aspects of it.
Right.
And it ain't so ugly when things are up and to the right. It's actually trade desk guys aren't really bitching and moaning right now about being public. Critio isn't either.
That's true. Those are the two high flyers
yes,
right now.
Exactly, yeah. Right now. And so the benefit of going public is the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So as you keep alluding to, perhaps winter is coming for certain segments of the industry. It's getting more expensive to rent equipment. It's getting – the take rates are going down, mm-hmm. As we've acknowledged. That's not for the faint of heart. If you are venture-backed, that spigot has been turned off. So you
for quite some time.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So you can't go back and tin cup your investor. Mm-hmm. So about the only way that you can get yourself out of that is to cut yourself out of that, right? You cut your way, cut costs. This year, we've stated publicly that we're going to increase our investment to drive down our processing costs, because I think, and I think you'll acknowledge in this world going forward, that's mm-hmm. going to be so important.
Yeah.
We have a balance sheet of $190 million, mm-hmm. and we're going to utilize it. And we would never have that cash if we didn't go public. Mm-hmm. We also have the ability to print shares of stock. A lot of people believe in the Rubicon story. They wouldn't mind optionality. They may not be elated exiting at this point, but if they could trade paper, you can't do that as a private company, because then you're saying, oh, my paper's worth this. No, my paper's worth this. And so so there are those are the really good things as it relates to the core business. Mm. Obviously, the other white noise is not so great, it was necessary. It was a smart move for the company to do it, and thankfully – I and the rest of the team would be the beneficiaries of that move because of the balance sheet and our ability to utilize it to make this company what we think it can be.
All right. Terrific. Now, just one or two more questions. One on sort of marketplace dynamics, consolidation. We've talked about it a little bit here. Obviously, the last 2-3 years have seen a big consolidation in the DMP space. DSPs also. SSPs have... I think people have been waiting for the big consolidation to happen. And, you know, there was a lot of talk that Rubicon was going to be part of a roll-up, private equity roll-up, which didn't happen. They hired you instead.
Door two.
Door two. But I'm curious what structural changes you think might still be coming to the marketplace. You don't have to speak only to SSPs, just broadly. Things are always consolidating. So right. I'm not a person who believes that this will be the year of consolidation. I think last year and the year before also were. But what do you think things are going to look like in a year or two?
Yeah, I mean, for a relatively mature industry, you know, you pointed out in the data management business, DMP, in the buying mm-hmm. business, in the transacting business, the SSP exchange world, it's mature. You don't see a plethora of startups entering in. And so,
do you think that's because innovation has played out, or just there's not money available?
I think the white space on the Luma chart has become so pixelated that to really come up with something that can slide in and blow it up, I think generally speaking, you're looking more like features or products, not companies, and that's hard to enter into, muscle in, sharp elbow in. It's not impossible. It's been done. I think you always have to be cognizant of that. But the reality is it would require, at the scale we're playing now, 50 trillion impressions a quarter. It's not an AWS solution. Mm-hmm, you're talking about heavy metal. You're talking about engineering firepower. And so I think there's a moat. It's not alligator infested, but there is barriers to entry. And sure, any mature industry consolidation occurs. I think fragmentation isn't a positive. I think the number of choices are confusing. Everyone wants choice, but there's a limit to it. So I do hear resonating with clients that they don't want all their business to be in one hands. They love a thriving, independent, healthy, globally scaled alternative to perhaps working with a partner that may own and operate inventory, that may have a sales team. I think that's what they mean by independent. I think people throw the word independent around all the time. I hear the folks at AOL use it, and frankly, they own a sales force, they own inventory. I don't know what that independence means there, but for us, independence means you stop at the edges. You don't hire a sales team to go out and compete with your buyers, and you don't create inventory to compete with your sellers. That's of high appeal. That healthy partner is of high appeal.
So there's going to be at least one of those.
Exactly. Are we that one? I sure as heck hope so. But yeah, I think that the market will lean into that. There's no question. And so that's probably where you have most of that consolidation. If there are a lot of people that look like that, some fall off, some get together, and next thing you know, you're definitively thought of as that person. And that's, I think, where the market's going.
All right. Michael Barrett, thank you so much for coming in. I really enjoyed having you here.
Great seeing you again.
This was terrific. And for the listener, thank you so much for tuning in to yet another episode of AdExchanger Talks. See you next week.
Recorded at the studios of Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.